Hello, gentle listener, and welcome to Michael and Ethan in a Room with Scotch. I'm your host, Michael Lilienthal, and this is my guest, Ethan Bartlett.
Hi.
I don't know about you, Ethan, but I feel like I'm being haunted.
I mean, in a sense, this whole podcast is a haunting, right?
Ooh, we are haunting the ears of our listeners.
Because, I mean, we were recording this in the past by at least, like...
It's true.
A couple months, I would guess.
There's a very good chance that one of us is dead when
oh wow okay
the listener hears this.
I'm not sure if that's like a threat or a like prophecy that I would rather you hadn't made. But
that's
what
for us to find out and the listener to know.
But also, what is a threat other than a prophecy someone wishes you hadn't made?
I mean, that's fair. That is not a bad definition at all, actually. So,
yeah, I'm starting to feel like we're discussing the fishermen again.
Oh, no. Oh, shoot. We're back to that again.
Which does involve a prophecy.
Chestnut.
It does involve a prophecy that leads to a murder someone didn't really want to do, so.
So, I mean, it's basically the same thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, speaking of prophecies and murder, this is a podcast about books. It's not about scotch, but we are going to be drinking scotch. We are drinking, Ethan, the Jura single malt scotch whiskey aged 12 years. Jura 12, from the Isle of Jura. So.
Yes, and I meant to tell you this before we started recording, but... Now everyone gets to hear it. I almost was not able to acquire the Jura 12.
Oh, yes.
Because, originally when I went to look for it, like, weeks before we were originally going to record this podcast, the total line that I looked for it at had the Jura 10 and the Jura 18... And said, out of stock on the Jura 12. So I did
I mean, really, all you have to do there is buy them both and mix them.
All right.
And you get a 12, right?
That's the
average.
The podcast. First of all, it's not. You'd get a 9 if that were the thing. And second of all, the podcast is over. Like, we're done. Wait, I did... No, you'd get a 14. So you would
get a
better
one. Yeah, so you just have to add a little more of the 10.
I hate you so much. Like... I'm going to just end this recording right now, sample you saying that, and send it to every scotch maker, and get you, like, lifetime banned from ever being sold scotch.
No! Oh, speaking of prophecies that people wish we had given.
Yeah, how do you like it? No, anyway... So I then, like, waited until literally the last possible, like, free afternoon I had before we were supposed to record this podcast originally, one Gregorian week ago, at which time I started at that total wine where they were still out of stock, even though I'd given them, like, 2 full weeks. Oh, and in my original text to you, I had expressed utter confidence that, like, given that we had... at least a couple weeks, I would easily be able to acquire the scotch. Then either called or went to fully 6 other liquor stores in the area that I live in, and they all either did not carry Jura 12 or were out of stock on it, and most of them were
there. Oh, man.
So I did end up buying the Jura 10, and just calling it close enough.
Sure.
And then the next day, which was the day we were supposed to record this originally, you texted me to inform me that you were sick. So I did then decide that the Jura 10 was just a normal drinking scotch and not a podcast scotch, and I have acquired the Jura 12. So your illness actually was somewhat fortuitous in that way. And also in the way that I got an extra bottle of scotch for myself.
Perfect. I'm glad I could perform the tragic comedic reversal for you.
Yeah, your sacrifice of being sick for a few days did lead to my benefit, so.
Right. So, perfect.
Having a hard time being sorry about that.
You're welcome. Well, let's get your wife to read the rules of this here show.
Hi, Karen. Hi, can you read the rules?
Rule 1. Once the scotch is poured and the glasses clink, the scotch must not be mentioned at any time. If anyone mentions it, they lose. Rule 2. No one's mother should be mentioned in any pejorative sense or any other sense not directly indicated by the text of the book being discussed. If any mothers are mentioned, the mentioner loses. Rule 3. Ethan must never say the phrase, first paragraph. If he does, he loses. Rule 4. Michael must never say the words, vampire, vampiric, or any derivative thereof. If he does, he loses. Rule 5. If anyone has to use the bathroom during an episode, he or she loses. However, this should not stop anyone from doing so because this podcast is anti-UTI. Rule number 6. The wives are entitled to one glass of scotch or some equivalent beverage. Rule number 7. If 4 scotch-centric episodes pass with no losses, then everyone loses.
And what happens if someone breaks the rules?
If one person breaks a rule, they receive a punishment in the form of a verbal stunt chosen by the person who did not break the rule. All that being said, everyone, drink responsibly.
Yeah, Ethan.
Yeah, Michael.
Gentle listener.
Thanks, Karen. This concludes the ASMR portion.
Good. Sláinte.
Schlenk.
As I said, Ethan, we are discussing books. And the book we are discussing today is The Sentence by Louise Erdrich. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly.
I'm actually pretty sure you are.
I did have hopes, actually, of, among other things, meeting the author at her bookstore and asking her that question, how to pronounce her last name.
Sure.
Because she works and lives in the Twin Cities, which is not terribly far from where I currently live, so I could feasibly have made it at some point. But in the time that I was perhaps most available to make such a drive, I was also solo parenting 3 children, so wasn't going to happen.
Sounds like Twitter talk to me.
Oh, them's fighting words.
I mean, to be
fair, this is,
I first read Louise Erdrich fully 12 years ago, and in that pace of time, I have never lived more than 4 hours from where her bookstore is, and I have never gotten there. So, yeah, I don't actually have a lot of moral high ground on the whole Twitter talk rhetoric, but as always, that's not going to stop me.
No, I mean, well, the lesson just is that we both suck, so that's how it is. But, okay, so The Sentence was published in 2021, and it is, I think, honestly, the first COVID-specific book that I've read.
Sure.
And that's fascinating to me for a couple of reasons. One, I can remember when I started being interested by the trend of early 2000s media, meaning books, movies, TV shows, and things like that, and seeing some thematic trends going on there. And so this is just maybe another step in that sort of thing of recent history and the examination of recent history in that way. And so how COVID itself gets interpreted in art.
Yeah.
And I think what Louise Erdrich does is a fascinating fascinating thing with the whole of the year 2020, basically. So the book takes place mostly from the end of 2019 through to the end of 2020.
Yeah.
There are parts of it that come before. The first chapter or so takes place beforehand, and I want to talk about that at some point too. But then the bulk of it is in the year 2020 and deals with a lot of current events, things going on there, especially when you think about the fact that this is taking place in the Twin Cities in 2020. There are a lot of current events that are the ground zero for that. So it's fascinating, to say the least. So I want to think about all that.
Yeah. I have a lot of thoughts about COVID literature and COVID in literature.
Yeah.
Because it is something that's really fascinated me. And you know, I'm sure that your initial thought about, like, it probably being a continuation of sort of recent trends, I'm sure that there's a lot that could be fruitful there, and you know, a lot of through lines. But at the same time, like, one thing that I think is really, really fascinating about COVID in even movies as well as literature is it feels like the first time in sort of the I don't even know what to call the period, like the postmodern period or even the post-postmodern period, that we have lived in real time through an event that we knew would be remembered, like, for sure we knew would be remembered in history, in the same way that, like, the great influenza of the late 19-teens and early 1920s was, or other plagues, or other just events that completely impacted the entirety of the world, like,
sure,
in some ways, you know, COVID was as impactful as a world war, for example.
Right, where we could say, while in the middle of it, this experience, this event will live in infamy.
Yes.
You know?
and like people, you know, in the middle of such events, like, I don't know that we always will necessarily... Like, I don't know that means anyone is necessarily correct about how, why, or in what way it will live in infamy. We just know that it will.
Mm.
And it's fascinating that I think we've had a lot, like... I'm gonna, as usual, use a webcomic to try to illustrate something deeper. But I remember the webcomic XKCD had one... I don't know, it was somewhere in either late 2020 or sometime in 2021, I want to say, where it was commenting on how most films, or at least a lot of like sort of mainstream films, quote unquote, have for a long time taken place in sort of a vague present. Like, just if you think about, like, an action film, for example, you know, it's like, oh, they've kidnapped the president's daughter, right? And it's like, the president won't be any current or recent real president. Like, that part will be fictionalized, but it's like everything else will be like, this could have happened yesterday or tomorrow or last year or next year in terms of, like, where the technology is and just social trend. Like, there's been it's, you know, and it's a fairly basic and convenient storytelling device, right, to just kind of fuzz out the background like that, so it you just kind of don't have to worry about it or account for it in the story. And it was like, this webcomic was sort of just had someone watching TV, and this was still, this must have been in probably late 2020, because I think this was still in a context where it's like, the vaccines hadn't come out, and you know, not everything was opened everywhere, and while that was true in America, Europe and large parts of Asia, if not most or all of it, were still completely shuttered. And this person was, like, watching TV and saying, like, Well, and there was, you know, just two people who were like, I don't know if they were about to kiss or something, but the person was like, okay, so they're not masked, so are we supposed to think that they're, like, irresponsible and inconsiderate? Or are they just, like, have they just been living together? And it was just, like, pointing out, and the caption even was something to the effect of, like, it was something like, shows and movies set vaguely in the present will be a problem for at least a little while yet, or something. Where it's like, there's a real sense, you know, here that we're recording this in 2024, there's a real sense that, like, a lot of those kind of generic action shows or movies take place either... for a while now, I mean, maybe in 2024 we're starting to move out of this consciousness, but for a while it was like most of those types of shows, if they didn't want to deal with, oh, do you wear masks, do you not, do you whatever, any of those mm-hmm. numbers of questions, it was like either they sort of tacitly took place in 2019 or in like 2025, like somewhere where we were, you know, we could, it was sort of a vague present, but it was like safely out of that window of time.
Mm-hmm.
And like, I think that people who, you know, literary writers, whatever sort of definition you want to put to that, that phrase, I think that they're interested in almost the opposite of that. And in that sense, and maybe in no other sense, COVID was kind of a gift to them because it literally shook the entire world and it gave mm-hmm. them something to, as like a lens, as like a universal experience, like in a lot of those ways it's like a gift to a writer.
Yeah.
You know, in as much as like gifts to writers often come in the form of horrible traumatic phenomena that hurt and kill millions of people sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah, right.
Like I'm not trying to use the word gift in the only word that comes flippant. To mind is yes, flippant. Hey, I was gonna say pejorative, and I was like, that's not the right word. But yeah, I'm not using it in too flippant of a sense. But it's like, it's as if a whole generation of writers like suddenly found themselves in the midst of a World War II and just got to chronicle what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
And then I will say just. I'll try to say this briefly now, and if you're interested or if it comes up, we can go back to it later. As far as I can remember, I have read two other novels that feature COVID in them.
Mm. Okay.
The first one that I read was by Emily St. John Mandel, or St. John Mandel, however one says mm-hmm. her name. And it was called Sea of Tranquility. And it came out, I want to say in 2021, possibly in 2022. And so she'd had a little bit, maybe even a little bit more time than Louise Erdrich had to process and sort of conceptualize. Her concept for that novel, like a lot of her novels, is kind of fragmentary and takes place over several different periods of time, like, and there's like time travel and stuff in it, but like some of it takes place during COVID, and then some of it takes place like 300 years in the future, and some of it takes place well into the past. And that was a fascinating phenomenon, or a fascinating concept, I guess, just in terms of like being able to situate like COVID as an event within like a time travel narrative. And it kind of became a meditation on like plagues of the past, as well as like a sort of speculation about plagues of the future, not necessarily in scientific terms, but in sociological terms, in terms of like how we might think about them, how we might react to them. I've threatened to bring Sea of Tranquility to this podcast before. It may show up at some point. And again, if it does, like, probably my main fascination with it is as an example of what I would guess is and will be the emergent genre of COVID novel.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
The other one that I've read was a very recent, I think it was published in December of 2023. It was the first novel written by Tim O'Brien, or published at least by Tim O'Brien in 20 years. Tim O'Brien of the Things We Carried fame.
Right.
And it's called America Fantastica. It is an interesting novel. It's like a weirdly fun novel.
Okay.
It might make an appearance on this podcast. It's one of those novels that's like, it's not nearly long enough for a Mondo book, but it's a little long for like our standard. But it's a very like, it's kind of Coen Brothers-y. It's kind of like one of these like road trip stories where it's like one person does a crime and then they leave and then someone's chasing them, but then someone else is chasing the person chasing them, and you know, very road trippy. And it's like a lot of characters that you know, are in many and various ways could be fall under the heading of POSs, and it's one of these books that's kind of, again, very Coen Brothers-esque in that it like glorifies in the variations on POS that you can bring, and the mania that those sorts of characters can bring. And it's like they're all the sort of characters who like just are not paying attention, but the narrative, of course, like starts you in early 2019 and it keeps moving you closer and closer, and it's like you as the reader know that what's impending, but they're just completely unaware until it, like, it's one of those things that the story that the characters are in suddenly seems to impose some kind of deus ex machina things in terms of like how COVID affects the story, but it's like you as the reader have been quite thoroughly foreshadowed. But the foreshadowing is interesting because it's like Tim O'Brien doesn't have to do a whole lot in terms of setting us up to know what's coming. He just has to tell us what the date is.
Right.
But it, again, like, and believe it or not, all of this is kind of in terms of me contextualizing this book. But like this book, it kind of starts in 2019 and then moves us through. And the fascinating thing to me, and I think the Sea of Tranquility, I think, plays on this a little bit, but especially America Fantastica in the sentence, the fascinating thing to me is that the cues for the dramatic irony, the cues for the fact that, like, we know what's coming to some of these characters better than the characters do, come from our lived experience. Like,
right.
It's in a way, by some sort of how to write fiction standards, it's almost not playing fair, except that it works just fine and therefore is playing fair.
It does raise some questions of like what fair is in terms of writing dramatic irony like that, you know, like how much of it has to be in the text. And in 100 years, if any of these COVID books are studied, you know, if we want to just abbreviate it to COVID books,
right.
How much context will university students need to be given? How much will it need to be put in the framework of their American history or world history in order to get the context that modern readers are getting?
Right. And I think that,
which, like, in the sentence, like, she brings up these things where the main character Tookie is saying things like there was something on the horizon, you know, that comes up a couple of times as it's building up. So to an extent you don't need the context so much, because then it's given when it does come. But certainly having the lived experience heightens that dramatic irony. Makes it all the more clear,
and
if
it's,
you will.
A thing that's fascinating to me and to my particular like interests in both film and literature is like, I've had the experience that if, say, the sentence is read in 100 years, Some of it is opened up for someone by learning the context of the COVID pandemic. I've had that experience with like Victorian novels or with films made 75 or 100 years ago. Just in terms of like certain, even just nuggets of information or certain like world events that you learn about and suddenly, you know, the thing opens up again. So it's like to your question of like, how much is it playing fair and how much context is someone going to need for, to understand the sentence, say, in 50 years or 100 years? I think that the answer is both, like, we can't know, because, like, a lot of that is going to depend on both the history of the next X number of years and the stories that get told within and about that history.
Right.
But at the same time, I think that that question and that phenomenon that you're pointing to has happened throughout the history of literature.
Oh, yes.
You know, if you, there are certain things in Shakespeare's plays that it's like, if you understand, say, the history of like British military campaigns in Ireland and how and when they're happening in conjunction with when Shakespeare's plays are published or performed.
Yeah.
Like,
well, even just as simple as knowing that they were originally performed in the Globe Theater serves as a context.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. Like, when, what's the, Hamlet has a line where he uses the word globe and
yeah,
I forget what it is. It's like the globe.
Tread upon this globe, something like that.
Yeah.
What is that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there are just like multiple places where, yeah, where globe is used, and it's always like a perfectly valid metaphor or whatever. Like there's something perfectly valid going on, but it's like if you know that little in joke, that's a great example of like one. Or even just knowing that like in the period, like William would have usually been, someone named William would usually have been called Will, and there are multiple lines in Shakespeare like, again, I forget, one of the first lines in As You Like It is something about, like, bending you to my will or something, and it's like, if you have that in mind, like, that's a more obvious one, maybe, but, yeah,
sure.
It's definitely stuff like that, though.
Yep. I think, so, in terms of the lived experience and this kind of monumental shift of the tectonic plates that go on that COVID created for this book and in the current context, and why I thought to link this kind of mentally with the early 2000s is the similar lived experience that we had as much younger children is 9/11, right? That created a shift in a lot of ways too. It's been something that I've been interested kind of mildly to examine is the shift in literature and film and television and so forth from the years leading up to the new millennium, which kind of everybody thought would be the shift itself, is just the year 2000. And so going up to that and even through the beginning of 2001 to then 9/11 happening, and then what happened after that. I mean, even just in terms of Star Trek, the show Enterprise was going on, and like you can see a little bit of a shift from Voyager, which finished airing right as Enterprise was coming on. So like there's a tonal shift that occurred there, and it strikes me as something that would be interesting to see. I haven't read any other novels that explicitly include COVID, but I've read some poetry and such that has come out in the midst of it all, and bridging the gap, so to speak, that it seems to me there's something there and it's worth studying, worth looking at. But also I'm suspicious that, again, I don't want to be flippant, but I'm suspicious of the thought that even just as 9/11 was this great shift, that ultimately I think it didn't change the trajectory so much as it highlighted changes that were already there. I wonder if COVID kind of did the same thing. Not necessarily changing a trajectory and themes so much as highlighting something that's already there.
I mean, I think that distinction, I don't want to dismiss it at all. I think it's valid, but I think it also has a large amount of dependence on perspective.
Oh, sure.
I think that one person's, you know, tectonic shift might be another person's highlighting of what's already there. I also think that easily both are possible simultaneously.
Well, I think let me ask this in terms of the text of the novel itself to dive into that.
Yeah.
That the it's ostensibly a ghost story,
right?
And I do want to talk more about that, but I in a broader theme perspective, what effect does COVID have on Tookie that the existence of this ghost in her life doesn't already have?
Sure.
Which I think in a thematic way, the ghost and COVID kind of become the same thing, so right. That it becomes this picture of a society that's haunted by COVID and all of the other things going on. Just as Tookie is haunted by this ghost, but I think it does serve that it becomes an amplification of the haunting that's already there for her. You know that she's haunted by this ghost, and now because of COVID, because of the isolation, because of the fear of death, and a gruesome, horrific, painful death that her husband comes through experiencing in later parts of the novel, right? That's shown that way, that is so tied with this ghost that it just amplifies the problem of the ghost.
Yeah. I feel like the term amplified or amplification, whatever, does resonate a lot with my experience.
No pun intended.
Of COVID. Yeah. Thank you. in the sense that, like, I do, you know, I saw a lot of trends in COVID that I think were just, like, things that were going to happen already that just were exacerbated, and a lot of that
mm-hmm.
that I was tracking had to do with labor unrest, is the old-timey term for it, relations between
mm-hmm.
employers and employees, just in terms of, like, I think there were a lot of things, like, a lot of reckonings that needed to be had that maybe were had faster because of COVID. I did, as someone who was like in the restaurant industry, in the, you know, kind of that wing of things, like I could write a trilogy of dissertations on like the restaurant industry and COVID. Like, it was fascinating. In the you know, supposed ancient curse, may you live in interesting times, like, something that's fascinating is not always great to experience, but...
Right.
Specifically, like...
But it's good fodder.
Exactly.
It's a gift, Ethan. It's a gift.
Yeah, exactly. thank you. But yeah, like, partly, like, one theme I kept noticing, and this, you know, may just be very much... product of the, like, geographical location and even class sort of location that I'm in. Part of what I was noticing was, like, a lot of restaurants were folding or having troubles of various kinds. And they would always blame COVID, right? But what I was noticing was, like, and again, this is just anecdotal. I'm not saying if your restaurant folded during COVID, you were stupid, but...
It's broad strokes.
What I was noticing in the examples I got face-to-face with was that the restaurants that said they were having to close or whatever due to COVID, I was like, all the reason... Like, again, when I knew staff or when I knew people who had worked there, it was like, all the... earmarks were there that this restaurant was going to close in a few years. The only thing that COVID did was accelerate it. Whereas the restaurants that I have encountered where it was like management was doing a good job, like the owners cared and were involved, the employees were like well treated. Most of those were the ones that made it through. Now again, I think that COVID, among other things, like certainly has had the ability to kill restaurants that under other circumstances would have survived and stuff like that. Like, I'm not saying it's universal, but it's like, it's just an example that I saw where, yeah, COVID would just sort of take things that were there already and just either it would take something that was maybe going to happen in a few years and compress it into 1 year, or just take problems that were kind of already simmering beneath the surface and just make them bubble up. And like when you were kind of asking your extended remark slash question just now, the shortest answer that sort of I was coming up with was like what COVID does is essentially trap Tuki inside with her ghost.
Yes,
that it, you know, the ghost would probably have been there anyway. Like, I think you're probably right about that. But in a non-COVID world, it's a lot easier for Tuki to get away from it and ignore it and
drown it out, I think.
Drown it out, yeah. As she literally tries to do, more ways than one. But it would be a lot easier to do that, especially, again, even just in terms of, like, the ghost seems to target her when she's alone, and so in a non-COVID world, like, there's...
Which is classic ghost story stuff. Sort of structure, too. Yeah. And, like, maybe this is something to discuss more in the next episode, too, but there are ways that this book serves as a postmodern ghost story, with all of the classic tropes of a ghost story, in terms of the isolated experience and the questioning of whether it's real or whether it's just, you know, all these other rational explanations for whatever's going on, you know, it's always there. But with that isolation, I think that which it surprised me a little bit going into this book, knowing that it was a COVID book, that the isolation wasn't as at the forefront as I perhaps expected it to be. Which is fine. That's not a criticism, but the isolation still exists in certain ways, in especially the context of the ghost that targets her while she is alone, especially, and how the ghost is ultimately dealt with is when she reaches out to her community, when she has input from others and can attempt different tactics and study things in a group. You know, it's a Buffy the Vampire Slayer sort of situation where you get everybody hitting the books all at once, and then they find out what the problem is and enact a plan of action. You know, that's kind of the scene that we get in this book.
I mean, the other thing that was occurring to me about sort of. Well, first of all, I wanted to talk about the isolation that you just mentioned, because I do think a lot of our experiences of COVID feel very isolated. Like, if we were to just sort of surface level describe what that experience was like, it would often be one of isolation. And I do feel like in all three of the novels that I've read, like, that's not what's focused on, and I feel like part of what I think is, you know, sometimes authors have this kind of, it's like kind of cantankerous, but kind of necessary thing of, like, not wanting to write the most obvious thing. And so it may just be that, but I think that also, that, like, when you're writing about something, sometimes the words that you say, what you put down on the page, is to describe the opposite thing, and so you're sort of writing about the thing by negative space. And so all three COVID novels that I've read have focused a lot on what relationships were able to sort of obtain, not necessarily flourish, but at least be there. So you know, the COVID novel, I think going forward will be a lot about like couples isolated together or families isolated mm-hmm. together. You know, I mean, I'm just waiting for like a movie about COVID that's like just a very slight reworking of the like, you know, pioneer family in the woods that goes insane and someone brains, they all brain each other with axes or something like that horror movie is coming. The other thing that I was thinking about in this, in both this connection and in your question of like, what does the ghost change about Tookie's life? How did you say it? What
does COVID change about Tookie's life that the ghost doesn't?
And not that this is a direct answer to that either, because, you know, as an aspiring author myself, like, I also don't want to do the obvious thing. More to frustrate you, really, than anything else, but...
I'm honored. Thank you.
What I kept thinking about is the title of this book, which, for a two-word title... where one of the words is the, it's a heck of a multifaceted title. Because, of course... You have, you know, initially, like, just with chronologically within the book, you have initially Tookie's sentence, her time that she spends behind bars.
Right.
You have the sentence that Tookie thinks is, like, somehow able to just kill people. You have the sentence that ends the novel, and before that acts as sort of a through line, in terms of just like a multifaceted thematic through line. The door is open. Go. But I think that like the hidden, and it's not. Intentionally not very thoroughly hidden interpretation of that title does have to do with Tookie's experience and all of our experience of COVID being like a sentence, like a jail sentence, like a recapitulation of that. And I think for Tookie, it probably is like very on the surface. But it's, you know, it's, I think a lot of us, certainly myself included, felt starting in March 2020 like we had been sentenced to like an indefinite jail sentence. Like for quite a while it was like with each passing day it seemed like the sentence was getting longer rather than shorter.
Well, and you said something really interesting about the relationships that obtain through COVID, and I think that's kind of a key feature here, because I could have asked the question too, what did COVID change about Tookie's life that the ghost didn't, that her incarceration didn't, right? And her experience in the first chapter of the novel didn't. And in related to that, could we chop off the first chapter of this novel and still have the same novel is an interesting question that I've thought of in reading this. Not as a criticism, again, but as a thought experiment.
Sure.
Because it is very different from the Tookie we get at the first chapter is different in a lot of ways from the Tookie we get in subsequent chapters and through the rest of the book. And the expectations that were given by the Tookie of chapter one, I know it's not numbered, but that the expectations are not fully met. It's not entirely or explicitly about this reintegration into society, because as soon as she starts that reintegration into society, society itself disintegrates.
Right.
And that's, I think, one of the most fascinating turns that the author very subtly takes, all centering on the sentence in all of its multifaceted features, that Tookie should be feeling like an utter outsider, except for those, you know, select few supporters, but even those should feel like quiet voices in the general experience that we're led to believe is the common experience of someone who has gone through what she has gone through. But because of the ghost and COVID, those voices are, ironically, louder for her, so that she does get the support. She does get the relationships that are significant, that are allowed to obtain, in contradiction to all the relationships that would be defining her in another way, which is central to who the ghost is, too, Flora, and the sentence, again, that kills Flora, is central to this same theme of identity and who one desires to be versus who one actually is, and how much one's history defines oneself in life and death and so on and so forth. I think one could read this novel in a very rapid way and see it as utterly disjointed and uncentralized. There's a picture of the novelist, which we haven't even mentioned too, that the author herself is a character in this novel. And that's something we can talk about more maybe in the next episode too. But when she appears, she's discussed in her writing habits and stuff, how I forget what the exact phraseology is. I'm terrible at finding the page numbers in this right now, but that when she's writing, it's this almost trance state that she's writing in, or she goes up and she locks herself away in her writing room, and she's in this writing session, and she's going through that, and you can get a picture of that, especially if you read this rapidly and leave that picture there, that she's just throwing words at a page and then throwing that page at a publisher, and then here you have this disjointed novel. But that ignores the fact of how intertwined all of these sentences are, and it's not just the sentence, but it's the themes within these sentences that are intertwined and create an arc, really, for Tookie. And that's a question I wanted to ask you, is what is Tookie's character arc in this novel?
Sure. That's a great question. I don't know.
It's okay if you're not prepared to answer it right now.
Yeah, I mean,
we're getting close to the end of an hour here, so
yeah,
we can save it for the next one.
I mean, it's one I want to answer. I don't know that I will be able to, like, given any amount of time, at least any amount of time less than, like, rereading this whole book again. Because I don't know that that's what I was looking... I mean, there certainly is an arc, and it's... In a way, I guess my first thought is, like, it's an arc from isolation and... sort of a posture of, like, isolated defensiveness to integration into a community and valuing everything that that represents. But I'm not prepared to defend that thesis.
Fair.
I think that, like, what I was honestly paying attention to much more just... And I only have read this book once. It is one of those books that I read once and I got done with it and I immediately wanted to read it again. And then, as I usually foolishly do, gave in to the urge to just read the next thing instead. But I think what I honestly ended up paying much closer attention to the prose. And just like the moment to moment, stuff going on. And I think that, like, I completely agree with you that, like, someone who's bad at reading beyond the surface of something could read this book and think that it was very disjointed, and that maybe it was, like, you know, a stitch-up job that was, like, oh, you had four story ideas and you couldn't quite finish any of them, so you put them all together or something like that. But I think that also litigating against that idea is just the prose itself. Like, no writer mm-hmm. who crafts prose this beautiful is that slapdash in mm-hmm. any other aspect. And you know, that's not to say
yes.
there aren't books with beautiful prose that don't work on a structural level or whatever, but it's just like when you have someone who's at this level of skill with the written word, you have to just give them, like, they've earned, in my book, the benefit of the doubt in terms of, like, if you have an initial dismissive reading, like, you should be prompted to look deeper. I mean, that's the other thing that probably led me to not be paying attention so much to character arc, which, again, I'm asserting is there, but mm-hmm. In a way, like, every section of this book, everything from, like, each paragraph to even each sentence sometimes struck me as, like, fractal, almost, like, like, everything was kind of not repeating, but just sort of reflecting everything else.
Mm-hmm. Fractal is a fair assessment given the cover image of the novel.
Yeah, sure.
Too. but yes.
Yeah.
I think there is a connection in the character arc, and I like what you said about the isolationist to finding community.
And again, I think that another thing that makes me think that is the dramatic irony there, right? That
yes,
Tuki
right?
goes from
and
a time when that we all kind of probably were tempted to look back on when we were in the year 2020, a time of, like, carefree connection in which Tuki is
mm-hmm.
essentially self-isolating, and goes to a time where physically speaking, we all had to be a lot more isolated for a while, but that's the time that, like, kind of draws her into a community.
Right. Yeah, and I think that's a magnificent turn, because it creates the idea of the genuine community then, right? It's the essential community. How often didn't we hear the word essential again in our lived experience of this moment? And that it's the essential community that creates the essence of Tuki, that speaks to her essence, her essential self, who she is, and how she is defined within the community that is there for her. I think a related arc is connected to the themes of life and death. Mm. From the get-go, we have her willingly going into death, really. Mm-hmm. With a fiction that she's created in order to accomplish her own ends. She's going to pick up this dead body and take him away.
Yeah.
For really, really, I mean, as far as stupid crimes go, you can't get much better than this. And and that's brought out in the novel itself. Like, she reflects on it, how stupid this was. And it really is just like, while she's in it narrating this within the whole thing, just how utterly dumb the whole thing is. Anyway, from there, and, like, that's her first haunting, is she sees the ghost of whatever his name is. Is it Bradley? Mm-hmm. It seems like it should be Bradley, but yeah, she goes on, and from there, moving on towards the end of the novel, where she's been haunted by this ghost, but connects to life then, and the door is open, go again, that sentence yeah. that speaks to life, moving out, going, getting out, and having that life. And it's connected also with the character of Jarvis, mm-hmm. The infant who is kind of her grandson, that, I think she even says somewhere in there that he's got an old man name, and that juxtaposition of the old and young is brought out in the character of Jarvis. There's a point, I forget the page it's on, again, apologies, where she describes him as being wrapped up like a mummy, right? So again, this image of a dead thing, right. But it's this new life that's brought out here. And she, Tookie herself, seems like she can't really escape the idea of death itself, which becomes its own haunting figure throughout the novel. But life is there. This new life that nourishes her and comforts her and calms her and gives her new life is always there behind the visage of death. Mm-hmm. And she learns ultimately, I think, to see beyond that scary picture of death to the life that's lurking behind it.
Yeah.
I think that's her ultimate character arc.
In complete conjunction with everything you just said, can I read at least part of one of my favorite passages in this whole book?
Please do.
So I have a hardcover edition of it, but I think the page numbers are probably the same.
Probably.
It's, at least in mine, it starts at the bottom of 118. It's a long paragraph that ends a section. And it's the first time that she, I think it's the first time that she holds Jarvis. And I won't read the whole thing. I'm going to skip just for the sake of time. I'll skip a few sentences, but Tookie's narration says, Jarvis opened one tiny, dark, defiant eye. He stared hard at me without cracking a smile, but without crying either. What a cool character, I thought. He was studying me. I was unnerved by this, but also I was intrigued to have such a finely modeled intelligence in my arms. Maybe he did have the bitter dignity of a Jarvis. Let me say without reserve, Jarvis was exquisite. And then she describes Jarvis for a bit, which is very good, but I'm going to skip it just for...
It's great description. For time. Yeah.
This was the first baby I had ever been privileged to study. He didn't blink like the leader of a prison gang. So even there you can see, like, she's haunted by prison metaphors. She goes on to say, he stared holes through me. He saw straight into my heart and didn't seem to care that it was riddled with cowardice, hubris, stupidity, regret. Those things meant nothing to him. He saw that what was left of my heart was good and loving. He trusted me not to scare him, not to drop him. And again, like, the whole paragraph is great, but, like, I think that, just those last couple sentences I read in the context of both the rest of the paragraph and the rest of the story just wrecked me the first time that I read it.
Oh, of course, yeah.
Because it's such a picture of grace on, like, so many levels. But also, I mean, part of the haunting that's going on here, and part of, especially, like... I keep wanting to call it the prologue, sort of the section that takes place up until 2019, you know, which is
it functions basically as a prologue.
In real world chronology, it's the longest part. In the space of the book, it's the shortest part. But besides all of the other much more explicit hauntings that go on, part of what comes out of that, and I'm not remembering all of the details or where it is, but, like, at some point, Tookie basically makes it clear that, like, part of the reason she was given such a harsh sentence, I think essentially boils down to racism, like, essentially,
something like
because
that,
she was, I mean, it's not said in so many words, I'm definitely...
No.
Strongly paraphrasing, but essentially it's made clear that if she had not been an indigenous woman, probably both of those things, that things very well may have turned out differently. And I think that in what's sometimes shortened to BIPOC communities, Black, Indigenous, People of Color, the fact that's pretty inarguable statistically that, like, those communities receive an disproportionately high number of sentences and harshness of sentences is, like, a haunting that's personalized and crystallized in Tookie, but that does affect this community disproportionately. And I think part of the hope and part of the grace of this baby, I don't subscribe to, like, the blank slate kind of theory, but, like, there is to a baby or from a baby, you can get the sense of a being that has not internalized a lot of society's prejudices. Like, the baby doesn't look at Tookie and see an ex-con. Which is what everyone else sees her, including arguably Louise. And Louise sees her as an ex-con that Louise wants to help and goes sort of out of her way to help. But it's still, they're both trapped in a system that sort of renders Tookie this way. And I think that, like, part of the grace of this moment is Tookie getting to experience someone looking at her and studying her. And it's less important whether the baby likes her or not. It's just that the baby is finally someone who doesn't see her sort of in this way.
Yeah.
I may have any or all of that completely wrong. Like, half of me is envisioning Louise Erdrich stumbling across our podcast and hearing this, and if that happens, Louise, write me an email, tell me I'm wrong, or anyone else who, you know,
please,
who wants to also
would be happy to hear.
Also write me an email and tell
we'd
me
be I'm happy wrong. To hear that Ethan is wrong. Yes. Please tell us Ethan is wrong.
Exactly. but yeah, that said, like, that was a passage I wanted to bring up at some point, basically, and you gave me the perfect in to do so.
Well, once again, you're welcome. And on that note, I think we'll cut it off for this time, and we'll come back in 2 weeks to complete our discussion of The Sentence by Louise Erdrich. In the meantime, gentle listener, you can find us on tapestryradio.org/scotchcast, or go to the contact section and send us your thoughts and feedback as you read along with us. You can also submit your homework to us on that website. We don't promise to do it well, but we promise to do it in a way that'll get you hauled off to plagiarism jail if you turn it into your professors or teachers. Specifically, we're looking for, like, English literature homework, but, I mean, you can technically submit any homework you want to. It's more likely to be done if it's, like, lit homework. Yeah, we'll do that.
I mean, if you submit your physics homework, we'll do it like lit homework, which could be entertaining for everyone.
Definitely. That could be fun. But, yeah, go ahead. Use the form at the top of the page there, tapestryradio.org/scotchcast, and enjoy what you find there. Ethan, anything to promote?
Nah. I pretty much live in a hole.
All right. Yeah, I mean, don't we all, since COVID?
I mean, listen, not to brag, I was doing it before COVID.
Before it was COVID?
No. Absolutely
not. No, okay. I was trying to, yeah, that's okay. All right. Anyway, so see you next time, gentle listener. And with that, it's our party. And just remember, we'll cry if a ghost makes us cry.
Obscurantism and obfuscation.
Orally observed, gentle listener.
Gentle listener.
Gentle listener.
Gentle listener. Gentle listener.
Obviated objects of oblivion.
Obambulating about.
Offered unto you.
Offered unto you.
Offered unto you.
In the Tapestry Radio Network.
TapestryRadio.org.
From our fancy to yours.